We have been talking this week about how we're going to survive as a church into the future. We talked on Monday about protecting the next generation, setting the stage so that the next generation can be greater than the current generation. Yesterday we talked about teaching, keeping, and restoring those that are in the church but are struggling or maybe have fallen completely away. And today our topic is convicting the non-believer. So now we're going to branch from issues inside the church to now how do we gain membership from those that are outside the church? How do we convince them that they need to be here, that they need to be saved, that they have a need for God, that the Bible is relevant to their life? Now, as I think about convicting the non-believer, I think first about 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. What does 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15 tell us? And be what? Be ready always to give a defense. What does that mean, to be ready to give a defense? An answer? An answer to what? Why I believe what I believe about the hope that is within me. Why the potential possibility of the world ending in 2012 really doesn't bug me that much. I just go about my regular business and I don't worry about it. Because in some ways, if it does, great. I don't know how long I'm going to live, but it saves me that much trouble in my life. So, but in some ways, it's a little disappointing because there are those that I have strong feelings that would not be saved that I wish were. So, I have to be ready to give a defense. And to me, part of being ready to give a defense is kind of trying to have an idea of what the issues the other person may have with what I believe before they ask, before I get in the discussion. Because then I'm not caught blindsided. I'm not having to think on my feet quite as much. Maybe when they respond a certain way, I can, okay, I kind of expect that. It's all right. I think I can handle this. It gives me a little bit of confidence. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about being ready and understanding what the other person may be thinking. What part of thought process they're coming from. I also want us to consider while we're doing this, Matthew chapter 13. What is going on in Matthew chapter 13, those first 23 verses? Parable of the sower. Okay, well, yeah, that makes sense. We're going to talk about spreading the seed. We're going to talk about reaching out. Let's go to the parable of the sower. But the part I want us to focus on is not what method necessarily he was spreading the seed, but I want us to think about the ground where the seed was landing. Because when we talk about convicting the non-believer in that parable is the ground, is he not? So we're throwing seed out and it's going to hit this non-believer. And part of the point, I think, of that parable is to help us understand here's some things to expect. Here's what might happen. And don't be shocked, don't be surprised, here's what might happen. If you recall, there was wayside. This is all review, I know that, but I just want, you'll understand a little bit why I want this fresh in our minds. There was wayside, which Jesus plainly stands, that stands for the one that hears but just doesn't respond at all. It's so compacted, the ground is so compacted and firm that the seed just can't do anything. Maybe it gets wet, maybe it gets a little warmth, and it starts to germinate, but it's not really going to grow very far. In fact, before too long, what actually happens to that seed on that wayside? The birds steal it. Some foreign entity, not part of the process, comes in and snatches it away. It's gone. Okay? Then there was also the stony ground. And the stony ground was the person that hears, maybe even responds a little bit, but there's no root. There's no root. So what happens? According to Jesus, what's the parallel?
Dries up.
I'm sorry?
Dries up.
Dries up. There's no root, so it can't withstand any sort of test. There's just nothing there to hold it down. Nothing there to continue to gain nutrients. Then the thorny ground. Cares of the world. This is the one that you plant the seed, you water it, it seems to be growing just fine, and all of a sudden something gets in the way that you didn't see coming. In the case of a plant, you know, the weeds around it, the thorns, they start to soak up the nutrients in the water from the soil, and the plant can't get it. It shades it so it can't get the sunlight, and it just dies. It withers up. Okay, so the cares of the world get in the way. And then there was the good ground. They heard the word, they believed it, it took root, it grew and matured, and eventually produced fruit. Everything was fine. Now what I want to do, these categories of skeptics that you have on your outline, those are not original with me, but I like them. So I'm going to use them. But as we do this, I want to do a couple of things. First disclaimer, what are the chances that you meet somebody and you can take them and figure out they're a square peg and they go in this square hole and that's where they fit? What are the chances of that happening? I'd say none. People try to figure out people all the time and we just don't fit into nice, neat little boxes like we would like to think. Best example I can think of is if this side of the stage represents conservative and this side of the stage represents liberal and I'm standing right here, am I conservative or liberal? What does it depend on? Depends on who's judging me. Because if I'm standing right here and the person judging me is over here, what am I?
Liberal.
I'm liberal. But if the person is over here, what am I?
Conservative.
I'm conservative. So I could be both, depending on who's talking about me. So it's important for us to understand that in some ways there's going to be a lot of overlap. Okay? There's going to be... So don't take this and go, oh, well, Doug, I know a person that's this and that and this over here. Well, I'll be so shocked if we don't know people that are in one category that also fit in another category because we're like that. We don't fit in nice, neat little boxes most of the time. Our brains are way too complicated for that. Also, I want you to understand that to begin with. I am not categorizing people and saying they're either in this box, that box, or the other box. That's not what I'm talking about. This is just concepts and ideas of the way somebody might be thinking. Also, as we go through here, I want us to think about, are they wayside, are they stony ground, are they thorny ground? I want us to think about that. Now, as we go through, what are the possibilities there? They're overlap. They might be more than one. Okay? They might really have trouble taking root, but cares of the world might show up and quicken their death spiritually. So we don't assume that I'm just saying, here it is, that's it, and take it and deal with it. Because there's going to be overlap in a lot of areas. Okay? All right, so here we go. The educated skeptic. This is the person that is too smart to believe in God. We're going to talk about each skeptic is going to have, I've got a section of who they are and some ideas of what we can do to try to reach them. All right. So who they are, the educated skeptic, they have intellectual objections. They've thought it through and decided intellectually. And it might be objections to God, it might be objections to the Bible, it might be objections to the church, there could be any kind of objections, but it's intellectually based. Many times, this person is a student of an educated skeptic. It's passed down. And they might be an educated skeptic. Yeah, they might be an educated skeptic just because they know somebody that is. And they've just accepted that mindset. They have a lot of pride. Now, we're going to talk about the proud skeptic in a little bit. Here's one of those overlaps. This person's pride, though, is in their intelligence, their education, their ability to understand and comprehend. It's intellectual. And many times, at least the ones I've talked to from time to time, many times they are completely unaware of the mental gymnastics they go through to reach the conclusions they've reached. Okay, what can we do? First of all, I think we have to be respectful of their education. We shouldn't insult their perceived intelligence. However, we should also not be intimidated by it. Just because they have six letters after their name does not mean they're smarter than you. It just means they sat in a classroom a lot longer than you did. That's all it means. Now, if you want to get into an intellectual discussion with them about matter or about biology or about mathematics or ancient Chinese literature, yeah, they might be smarter than you. But when it comes to the Word of God, if you've spent any time at all in it, chances are you know a lot more than they do. Okay, so respect their intelligence, because you're going to just make them mad if you don't, and that won't accomplish anything. But don't be intimidated by it. Don't be intimidated. I think it's important with this type of an individual to first clarify the position they're taking. Clarify, repeat it back to them. Okay, now what you're saying is, and tell them what they said. And here's why I think that's important. When I've discussed certain issues with people like this, if I just jump right into my point of view, as soon as it begins to clash with theirs, if they begin to realize they're in a position where it's not, their position is unattainable, you know, they can't hold on to it, they just start twisting the things I'm saying and changing the things they said until it meets somewhere that they feel is more solid ground. I told the kids, I said, think of the politician that's misquoted. That's what happens a lot. They weren't necessarily misquoted, but they make it out to look like it was so that they can feel better about the position they've taken and it doesn't look so drastic and bad. After you've clarified their position, then you can start to point out inconsistencies. Because if they start to do the mental gymnastics to wrap you around somewhere, you can go back to, now wait a minute, we just said this is what you said. And then you can start back there again. Is it what you said or is it not? And we need to remember two things. They may believe what they do in spite of evidence. Remember, they may be the student of an educated skeptic and they're just taking somebody's word for what they think they believe. And also, they probably know what they know because someone they perceive as intelligent or an authority has told them, but not necessarily because they've thought it out themselves. Okay, what kind of ground do you think this is from the parable of the sower?
As they think.
I'm sorry?
The pathway.
The pathway?
Hard ground.
That's what I think. I can see some potential other things, but it seems to me with somebody like this, the hardest part is just getting the seed to take any kind of root in it whatsoever. Because it's so hard of a ground to try to work with. Any questions or thoughts on this type of an individual?
Well, I'm wondering if we need to just keep in the back of our minds going through all of this that regardless of what the person says, we don't really know what the Holy Spirit has been doing in their life.
Oh, absolutely.
How many other Christians have been saying this or that and getting them to think about things.
Yep.
So, you know, maybe that goes into the point you made about not being intimidated. You know, we need to realize we're not doing this on our own. God is working with us on this person, and we may be the 50th Christian.
Oh, absolutely.
invited him to a church meeting or talking about evolution or whatever.
One of the kids downstairs said it very well. He said, "We don't know what link we are in the chain that's trying to pull them out of the fire." It's a very good way to think of ourselves. We're just another link in the chain, and we're going to talk about that on some of the other ones. That it's not about us. It's not about us, but we need to try to be the best tool that we possibly can.
And another thing I want to point out was we might want to think about why we do not believe in the Book of Mormon. You know, we may have done a lot of studying. We may have seen how Joseph Smith made prophecies that didn't come true, such as a false prophet. Or maybe we just, you know, heard a sermon saying, well, yeah, Mormonism is untrue. And so we just accepted that without a whole lot of detail.
Right.
That this person rejecting the Bible, you know, may be that same way. Maybe because if you read some article in the newspaper about evolution, so, well, okay, I believe that instead of what this big thick book that I've never read says. Or maybe he's actually done a little research and whatever he found
right
didn't back up the Bible.
Right.
So we need to kind of give them a little bit of the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
That it's a far-fetched book. I mean, the water that covered the tallest mountain, covering the earth and all these miracles and stuff. I mean, we don't see that every day. So why would it have happened thousands of years ago?
Right. They are intellectual arguments, and these are not ignorant people. They are intelligent people. Their thought process has taken a track that is not in line with God, and it's the process of trying to pull them back to that way of thinking. And they don't change the way they think very easily, because in their mind they've got it all figured out intelligently. That's a good case, the instant of the mental gymnastic. Okay? Moving their mind around in a way that makes it appear to be one thing when it's really not. Okay. We'll move on. The next one I want to talk about is the wounded skeptic. All right? Now this is the person that they've abandoned God and the church. Maybe they had some sort of religious ideas before, but they walked away because of a negative experience of some kind. They are hurt. This is an emotional pain. It could be connected to a physical pain, But usually it's an emotional or spiritual issue. So there is some source of pain. Now, it could be an unforeseen circumstance. It could be some malicious person in their background that has soured them to the church or to God. It could be their own bad choices that's caused the pain. It really doesn't make any difference, except that they have some sort of deep-seated pain within them. And because of that, they blame God, either directly or indirectly. They may just outright say, well, God did this horrible thing to me and I'll never trust Him again. Or it may be kind of an around-the-bush blaming of God, sort of like Adam did when he told God, this woman you gave to me to be with me is why this happened. He didn't directly blame God, but he sure put Him in there. Okay? Some ideas of what we can think about or do. Before we even start this process, I want you to think about this in your head. If they're blaming God for something, what does that mean? They have some sort of belief in Him. You wouldn't blame something if it doesn't exist in your mind. If my car breaks down, I'm not going to get mad at the Gezordenplatte. What's a Gezordenplatte? I don't know either. I made it up. But my point is, I'm not going to be angry or get mad at or hold grudges against or some sort of a evil feeling or a bad feeling towards the Gezordenplatte, because I don't believe the Gezordenplatte exists. So why would I blame it? These people, if they're blaming God, there's some sort of belief. There's something in there, even a little bit, that they believe. They need compassion and love. Now, that should be present any time we're dealing with somebody. But I think especially here. Because they're hurting. Whatever the issue is, they're hurting. And if they're angry, that means they need to vent a little. You might just have to let them go for a little bit and just rage within themselves and talk it out. Let them vent. As they're venting, they may bring up why they're angry. And to you, from your point of view, remember we've got a continuum, from your point of view, it may be the most irrational thing you've ever heard in your life. But don't say that. Because to them it's real. It's real. The things they want to vent about that have hurt them may make you uncomfortable. They may even hurt you a little bit because maybe it's directed at a congregation that you know. Or maybe it's connected with the congregation you attend. And some that might hurt a little. But let them vent. That's doing two things. It's giving a release to the pressure cooker of their emotions. So they're going to be able to relax a little bit and talk to you rationally and reasonably. But it's also going to give you some really good insight into what's going on and help you figure out, how can I help them? What are some things we can talk about? And this is going to take, probably anyway, a long-term reciprocal relationship. They're going to have to, if you're a representative of God and the church and that's who they're angry at, it's going to take them a while to grow accustomed to you, to get comfortable with you, and to trust you. And you've got to let it take that time. And it's got to be reciprocal. There has to be some give and take. You help them with things, but give them the opportunity to help you. That's going to add to that trust. If your relationship with this person is only about you helping them, what are you becoming to them? A crutch. You're just becoming a crutch to them, another person that they can lean on, which is good for a while, but what's that going to do to you eventually? You're going to get tired and frustrated. And then if that relationship breaks down, Now what do they have in their life again? They have more reason to be angry at God. Because they have another person that was religious, trying to help them, that's now abandoned them. It's walked away.
You're not helping them learn to deal with their own problems.
No, you're not. You're giving them a fish every day instead of helping them learn how to cope.
Could you give a specific example of this reciprocal relationship?
Once in a while, when you have a problem in your life, talk to them about it. It doesn't have to be anything major. You know, just once in a while, let them understand that, hey, I've got problems too. And do you have any advice for me? You know, that type of a thing. So that they begin to feel a relationship, not a control. Does that make sense? It's not like I'm going to, you know, depending on the situation, if I've got problems in my marriage, I may not want to talk to them about that. Because, one, they may not be able to help me. And two, there may not be the trust there that I can do that. But I'm having car problems and I need to find a good mechanic. Do you have any suggestions? I'm having trouble losing weight. Have you heard? Do you know any way that I could try to shed a few pounds? See, just ways that you can help each other. Okay. What kind of ground do you think this might be? Stony's what I put. I think we could say some of it is the weeds, the thorns, because they have things from the world that are kind of choking them down. But it just seems like to me it's stony ground, because the word's going to have trouble taking root for a while until some of those rocks are pulled out of the way and something's done.
Yeah, it reminds me of Ezekiel, over in Ezekiel, where it talks about the Lord said, I will take the stony heart out of their flesh.
Good.
So we're trying to help break up and disintegrate that stony heart.
And that's exactly what that long-term process does. It slowly breaks apart and pulverizes that rock. And if you break the rock up enough, this is biology now, if you break that big rock up enough, what do you have? Soil. Sand and soil. Yeah, jackhammer doesn't work. Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions on the wounded skeptic?
An experience I had, I was walking with this guy at work, we walked at lunchtime, and so eventually I brought up the subject of religion or God or church or something, and he had had a bad experience at church, and I said something like, you know, well, don't let that get in the way of you having a relationship with God. Well, then he started defending that church. So,
well,
you have to be really careful when you're trying to help heal that wound.
Yeah. And that goes right back to what I was saying before, but that there's got to be some sort of a belief.
Right.
You know? And I can see, I don't know, I haven't experienced this with anyone, but I can see, like, in a situation like that, he may have been going through his mind, well, I don't want to totally make God mad at me. Because what if? So, good.
That thought occurred to me too, that even the skeptic is going to have time in their life when they don't know what to do. Death of a family member, break up of marriage, life-threatening illness, you know, that's the whole thing.
Right.
I think.
Absolutely. Sometimes we're the most open to a really important change in our life when things are going really bad is when we realize that. And so whatever has wounded them might be the very thing that they need to use in order to come back or to come to God in the first place, whichever it is. Okay. The frightened skeptic. Okay, this... To me, this is a person who is afraid how God's interference might change their life. There might be things that they don't necessarily want to change or want to be a different than what they are right now. One concept of this is they may believe, they may understand that or think that God is wanting them to switch off their brain. Now, this may be related to the intellectual skeptic. Because one of the things that an intellectual skeptic will often point out is that, well, you religious people, you just are non-thinkers. You just believe all this stuff, but you have no basis or reasoning to believe it. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. They also might be afraid of being asked to do something or to move outside of what they view as their comfort zone. You know, if you've never been around religious people very much, would it be a little bit intimidating to walk into a church building full of them? I think it might. They also might be afraid of giving up something that's important to them. But they're afraid of something about the church or God. I think of Luke chapter 18, verses 18 through 23, the rich young ruler. Remember, I think he may have been a frightened skeptic in a way. Because he thought he had it all together with the laws and everything, but when asked to give up something that was very, very dear to him, he didn't seem very willing to do that. Something about selling all that he had scared him away from God. So what can we do? Well, I think first we have to figure out what they're afraid of. Why are they afraid of coming to God? Why are they afraid of coming to church? Why are they afraid of whatever it is they're afraid of? And when we find that out, again, you notice a theme here. Don't minimize or put down their fears. They're very real to them. Whatever they are. Okay, so let's think. If they are afraid that they're going to have to stop doing something, they need to understand a few things. First of all, God does not ask Christians to be sequestered monks. There's a lot of people out there in the world that believe that once you become a Christian, you stop having fun. Everything's serious. You don't ever get to do anything enjoyable. And all you do is sit in church and read your Bible and pray, and that's all you ever do. Now we know, right? To us, that's unreasonable. Because we have a good time together. We play games, we go visit, we see things, we do things. We just don't do things that are against God's law. That's the only part we don't do. And so when it is, because here's the second part of that. Is it possible they're going to be asked to give up something that they really enjoy doing? Absolutely. That's the point of change and repentance. We all have to do that. Okay? They need to know that it's not up to their willpower alone. Because it might be they're afraid they can't do it. Their fear might be related, let's say they have a drug addiction. It might be that they're afraid they can't give up that. And if they can't give up that, they can't be pleasing to God, so I'm not even going to try. They have to understand that it's not up to their willpower alone that God will help them. They are going to have an active role in that change and that desire, but they're not in it by themselves. The church can help. But as you're trying to help a person like this, you also have to realize that you can't make them stop. Whatever it is, you can't make them, no matter how much you want to. They have to decide. You can help them. You can guide them. You can encourage them. You can lead them. But you can't make it happen. If their issue is they're afraid of having to switch off their brain, you need to help them understand that God encourages us to use our brain. He doesn't want us to be unthinking robots. Just automatic, well, this is what we do and this is how we do it and that's all there is to it. He wants us to think. That's why I think He gives us what we call, what we were talking about yesterday, what we call meat in the Scriptures. Difficult things. He wants us to think and to grow and to mature and to work into those things. He gives us things, you know, David said, the heavens declare the glory of God. Well, an unthinking person isn't going to notice that even. God wants us to think. He wants us to use our brain. If they are afraid of leaving their comfort zone, are they going to have to leave their comfort zone? Yeah, so be honest. Yep. You will have to get out of your comfort zone. If part of their being uncomfortable is walking through the doors of a building and meeting with Christians, they're going to have to get uncomfortable. Because that's something God requires. It's not optional. So they are going to have to be uncomfortable perhaps. But they will first be able to use the gifts and the things they are comfortable with. And when the time comes for them to move into things that maybe they're a little less comfortable with, God will help them. He will equip them. I like the saying, I don't know where I saw it first, but I've used it a lot. I like the saying, God does not call the equipped, He equips the called. Well, that may take time.
Yeah.
You know, perhaps, you know, if you've studied with them privately and they obey the gospel, maybe it's time to start a group study with a few people in your home or their home and get them around some of the Christians. Maybe it's time to, for no reason at all other than this, to plan a cookout at somebody's house and invite them to come over and start building those relationships so when they walk through the doors of the building, they don't feel as uncomfortable. What kind of soil do you think this is from our parable? Thorny. This is definitely thorny ground, I think. There may be some rocks under those weeds, but it's the thorns of the world. It's the things of this world that are really keeping them from doing the right thing, from being obedient.
I think your point about not being intimidated by the skeptics, especially the ones that are very intelligent, is important to remember. The nature of the gospel is that God chose the foolishness of preaching to save those who believe. Where is the wise man? It is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. They have to get to a point where they figure out that their wisdom, just because they're smarter than most everybody else, doesn't mean that they're right. Satan is probably one of the most intelligent beings God ever created, and he's chosen a foolish path. And the person who's on this path has chosen a foolish path. And so God left us with the gospel. The gospel is what saved us. Mm-hmm. It's the wisdom of God. It's the answer to all of life's problems, whereas we keep philosopher keeps trying to philosophize about everything.
Right.
And he'll come up with objections to faith. But it's the only answer.
Yeah.
The only answer.
To just kind of summarize that whole thing, that the gospel is meant to be simple. So that almost to the point where it's so simple that somebody that feels they're very intellectual decides it's foolish. It can't possibly be right. It's too easy.
One of the Proverbs says, don't answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise and unconceived. Answer a fool according to his folly. The very next sentence. It reminded me of that story about Benjamin Franklin. He had acquaintances that were atheists and skeptics. He built a model. Benjamin Franklin built a model of the solar system, showed it to one of his atheist friends, and the atheist friend was very impressed because it was a good model, and said, "Who made that?" And Benjamin Franklin said, "No, nobody. It was an accident." That was answering a fool according to their folly.
Yeah. He recounted the... could everybody hear his account? He recounted, a story about Benjamin Franklin, who had an atheist friend, and he built a model of the solar system.
Benjamin,
who did I say?
No, he.
Oh, Benjamin Franklin built a model of the solar system and invited the atheist friend over and showed it to him, and the atheist friend was quite impressed. And when the atheist, when Benjamin Franklin asked him, the atheist friend, asked Benjamin Franklin, who built this? And Benjamin Franklin said, nobody, it just happened, it was an accident. The fool and his folly, answering him with the same argument that he uses and making a point that it's no argument. Okay. Sure. No, not necessarily. No. They're just scared. Something about the idea of being a Christian scares them. When I think about these things, sometimes it's hard for me to really get a grasp that somebody thinks this way. But there are people out there that just the idea of trying to make right and moral and good choices and being responsible for those choices scares them. They don't think they can, so why try? And I can kind of explain that position, but I really can't absorb it because I've never felt that way. If that makes sense. But they're not lazy. They're not bad people necessarily. These may be very good people. The frightened skeptic may be the moral neighbor that lives next door that you constantly say, if they just come to church and be baptized. That may be this person. But something's in their way. Something's in their way. Okay, the proud skeptic. They're arrogant, aggressive, and unshakable in their belief, whatever it is. Okay? They often perceive no need in their life for anything. They've got it under control. In effect, they're telling God, I don't need you. I don't need you. They often believe that they are good enough for God. They may be arrogant and boastful. If somebody is a proud skeptic, you won't have to guess. They'll tell you. Because they're going to let it be known. And the pride could be anywhere. It could be in any part of their life. The intelligent skeptic, the educated skeptic, they're going to have their pride in their education. But the proud skeptic in general, their pride could be anywhere. And I think you'll understand what I'm talking about in a little bit. They may just think I'm not as bad as the other guy. They may be using the continuum to figure out whether God's going to take them or not. Believing that instead of pass-fail, God is grading on a curve and I just got to be on the right side of that curve and everything will be fine. And if I can make it, so they look around and go, well, I'm not as bad as that guy, and I'm not as evil as that person, and wow, look at all those people in that country. I'm better than 90% of them, so I'm doing pretty good. This one is going to take a long-term relationship because you've got to break down and wear down that attitude a little bit. And that long-term relationship is not going to be easy, is it? Because it's going to be difficult to be around this person very much. Because they're going to be the pea underneath your mattress with the princess on top. They're going to just irritate you because they know they can. Okay? That's their tool. That's their defense mechanism. I think it's also good to understand that, at least I think, a lot of apologetics and info dumps of information and gotcha arguments, I don't think they're going to work. Because they're too proud for that. That's not going to break that barrier down. And this is why. When you express that they need God, you're undercutting their entire worldview of their personage. Who they are is greater than that. So when you try to express that they need God, it's going to be very hard for them to accept that. Now this next one, it's true with all of them, but I specifically put it on this one because at least for me, this kind of a person is the one I need it more with. Pray, pray, pray for time and patience. And that's true for all of them. If you're trying to talk to somebody outside of the church and study with them or work on them to soften them or convict them of the need for God, if you're not praying, I don't know what you think you're trying to do. Because remember, we water and plant, but who gives the increase? God. And if I'm not asking for that, God says, why would I do anything for Him? If He doesn't truly believe I can provide. Sometimes, yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Remember, if you offer to try to help them, to reach out to them in some way, they may have the attitude, I don't need your help. They may just flat refuse sometimes. I don't need your help. So remember that your first goal is to be a faithful Christian. That's your first goal. Because you can soften them up a little bit just by showing them what a humble, meek, loving Christian is. And when they're ready for the apologetics, you be too. Because eventually they're going to start asking questions, or you're going to see an entryway that you can bring something up, and you're going to need information. Because it's going to take something, some biblical concept or teaching, to break down that pride somewhere. Now this proud skeptic category, I think they have a special case. The religiously proud skeptic. I think this is kind of an interesting concept. They're so sure of their righteousness that you can't convince them otherwise. They're so positive that you can't talk to them. And this could be from any religion. It doesn't have to be from a Christian-based religion. It could be Christian or Hindu or Muslim or anything. Mormon. It doesn't make any difference. Think about the Pharisees. They were religiously proud. They thought that their religiousness was good enough. And then, yes, they were hypocritical. But more importantly, I think they were proud. I think if I catch some of the things within that Jesus is talking to them about when He's interacting with them, it's almost as if they had started to think we don't need the Messiah to save us. We have Abraham. We have circumcision. We have the temple. We have the law. We don't need anything else. I'm going to turn to Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18, and I want to read starting with verse 10. Two men went up to the temple to pray. Remember this? One a Pharisee, one the other a tax collector. Listen to this Pharisee. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other men. Sound familiar? Extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. And here's the pride part. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. Does that sound like the religiously proud? It does to me. They had it all figured out. They had it all down pat, and they didn't need anybody to tell them any different. Yeah, praying with himself. That's such a great phrase that Jesus uses there. Praying with himself. Perhaps God wasn't even listening. They need to be shown. I'm not sure telling them that they're prideful does much. They need to be shown. Isaiah 64:6. But we all like an unclean thing, and all our righteousnesses are like filthy rags. We all fade as a leaf, and our iniquities, like the wind, have taken us away. The religiously proud doesn't need that verse, because they're fine. They're fine. What kind of ground do you think that the proud skeptic or the religious skeptic might be? This one, I think, is a little harder. To me, anyway. Stony?
Pride and a hard heart.
The pride and a hard heart just doesn't let it take root. Okay, I agree with that. I wrote stony ground, no depth to belief. But I also wrote down thorny ground. Because often their pride, not necessarily in the case of the religiously proud skeptic, but the non-believing proud skeptic, sometimes it's pride in the things that they have in this world that is what gets in the way. Any thoughts or comments on the proud skeptic?
I like this passage in Matthew 11:25-30. At that time Jesus answered and said, I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you hid these things from the wise and the prudent, and has revealed them unto babes. Even so, Father, for it seemed good in your sight. All things are delivered unto me of my Father, and no man knows the Son but the Father. Neither knows any man the Father except the Son, and he to whomsoever the Son will reveal it. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden. That's the position we ought to get. We have to be like the babe, the child, that humble ourselves as children. We have to be weary and heavy laden. And that's when we're receptive.
Yeah.
When we're in good soil.
That's right.
Paul is an excellent example.
Yes.
For Saul.
Yeah. Saul was a religiously proud skeptic that had to be blinded and brought to his knees before he was open. Had to be shown. Excellent point. Well, let's try to get one more in. This one's not very long. The orphan skeptic. This is a person that has been abandoned, either literally or figuratively, by a father or father figure in their life. This is a very specific, I think, case and issue. They have trouble believing in the concept of a loving father. They have trouble wrapping their arms around that because they haven't experienced it. They mistrust the father. These are people that will often accept heresies, certain specific ones like a no gender god or a female god. A lot of times that idea will be grasped onto by these people. They may also be drawn into some sort of a cult that has a very strong, powerful father figure in it that they, for some reason, have decided to trust. They're easily duped sometimes by religious predators. I call them religious predators. People that prey on people's religion and their want for God, and they take advantage of that. They may often become an atheist. Just give up entirely on God. Instead of trying to understand or reinvent God or try to accept the idea of a father figure spiritually, they'll just walk away. They'll turn their back. Some things I think we can do, we can compare their fathers to God not God to their fathers. You see what I mean? If they've had a father that was abusive or walked away or whatever the issue was, if we start comparing God to their father, that's how it will turn out. God will begin to look abusive and cruel and mean. But if we show them who God is from the love and mercy and compassion side, and then we show their father should have been that way, that's a good way, I think, to relate their father to God. So we need to show examples of God being a good father. And show examples of people reacting to Him like a loving father. This is a good place to use Jesus, right? Jesus recognized the love of God for him and the protection God placed on him and the guidance God gave him and the encouragement. And he was very expressive and vocal about that in the things he said and did. Maybe focus on the concept of adoption. That when we join God's family, we are adopted in and then treated as if we are natural children. We're not an outsider that's just brought into the family to live on the skirts around. Now, I want to emphasize this one. Do not drift away or abandon them. They can't handle that. They need somebody to stick with them. And specifically, I think in this case, do not be afraid to suggest professional counseling. Because sometimes there are some very deep-seated pain and emotions in there that we're just, most of us anyway, aren't equipped to deal with. Now, if you can, find a good Christian counselor for them. Or find a brother or sister in the church that has experience with this or has been through this and can help them work through it. But if you start to feel like you're getting in over your head, don't be afraid to yell for a life raft. Okay? What kind of ground do you think this might be? Definitely. It's all about what they've experienced from the world and issues from the world. Any comments or questions about the orphaned skeptic? This one may be one of the most emotionally tearing people to try to work with. Because some of their stories are... You just wonder if they're making it up. Because they're horrible. Okay. Tomorrow we will... We're doing good. We're right on schedule. I can't believe it. We'll talk about the rest of these. I figured this would take 2 days. And we'll see if we can finish this idea up of convicting the outsider tomorrow. You have 15 minutes.